Last time we had lecture, we began talking about elimination reactions, I believe, correct? And I think, hello, we're starting now. When we did last talk about elimination reactions, I think we were working on different substituted cyclohexane compounds. Is that correct? Yes. And there was one reaction in particular that I asked you to try to determine if it was going to occur or not. Did anybody happen to look at that reaction?
Kind of.
Now that the quiz is over, hopefully you are starting to look at those kinds of reactions, but let's go ahead and cover it. And I don't know if this is exactly the same molecule that I had written for you all, but this exact situation is what I want to get into. So let's say that we have some kind of cyclohexane ring where we have a leaving group on one side of which there are no available hydrogens in order to be able to eliminate. And let's say, therefore, in this example, we have on the other side one hydrogen that can be removed. So we had covered the case already where we had a trans relationship between these two things on the ring, the leaving group and the hydrogen, to be removed. Well, this is the cis case. And so let's try to make a chair structure for this molecule to see if we're going to have that parallel or anti-parallel, or to use the more correct terms, that periplanar or anti-periplanar configuration that would actually allow elimination to occur. So I'll put the two methyl groups in this back carbon for the moment. So coming clockwise around there, we have bromine that's supposed to be pointed up, so it's going to end up occupying the axial position. And then hydrogen's pointing up, and remember back at the beginning of the quarter, if we had two things that were cis pointing the same direction, then if one was axial, the other one would automatically be equatorial, like what I've drawn here. This is just one possibility, though, so let's do the ring flip structure, which in the ring flip, it's going to look like I've moved the methyl groups. But that's only because I need to visualize this in such a way where I still have the bromine and the hydrogen both pointed up. And so in terms of convenience, in terms of writing this where I'm still have the same slant for the chair structure, that's why it appears that I've moved things around to different carbons. So bromine is going to be up still. Methyl group is still, or it's the hydrogen, I should say, is still down. Then we have the hydrogen that's up, and then the methyl group that is down. Can either of these give that periplanar or anti-periplanar configuration between the hydrogen and the leaving group?
No.
And we could more clearly see that if we were to make Newman projections. So you might remember back when we did tackle cyclohexane rings, we saw in lecture Newman projections for rings, but you never got quizzed or tested on it because I knew it would come up here. So if we were to choose to look along this bond, where I'll put my virtual disk in the middle here to see what the configuration of the hydrogen and the bromine are, the Newman projection would look like this. Just a reminder for Newman projections, those things that are in front are the ones we write with bonds that go all the way through to the center of the projection, and those things that are in back are the things that we write without bonds. So, at least not bonds going all the way through. So, bromine's at the top in the back, hydrogen is down and right, the rest of the ring is down and left, which I'm going to write a little loop here to show that it's connecting to this upper left point on the front carbon, and on that front carbon we have hydrogen and then the methyl group. Notice that there's only a 60 degree dihedral angle, so it is not parallel or anti-parallel, so elimination is not possible in that case. Now let's visualize a different bond, and this one's going to be tougher to do, and what I strongly encourage that you do is play with your model sets. And model sets are still allowed for quizzes and exams. So the next exam coming up, you are allowed to use them to answer a question like this. So if we're looking along that bond, we'll again have a configuration that looks like this. And let's see if we can figure out what is left, right, up, down. So looking in the back carbon, the methyl group is pointing out towards the left, which it's hard to see from the structure, but is coming out relative to this viewpoint. So I'm going to put the methyl group down below here. The hydrogen is up above. And then we have the rest of the ring on the right side, which is going to loop around to the upper right, the rest of that ring. The hydrogen is going to be pointed down, and then bromine coming up to the upper left. So in this case, we have another 60-degree angle. Again, it's not going to be in the correct configuration. So in neither case, that's kind of odd wording. In both cases, the leaving group, which is bromine, and the hydrogen that can be eliminated are neither syn-periplanar nor anti-periplanar . So elimination cannot occur. Questions? So I know it might be tough to remember, but when we did that trans case the other day, we saw that in one of the two ring flip forms, we did have anti-periplanar geometry. In this case, with it being syn, you can never get that geometry, so elimination just won't occur. Now, this is E2 so far that we've been talking about. Just in the interest of time, let's at least get to talking about E1. So E1, or unimolecular elimination. So anytime that you have a basic nucleophile, it's going to encourage E2 elimination, because that nucleophile being a base is actively going to pull a hydrogen off. For E1 reaction then, we're going to use something that has that's a poor nucleophile that's going to allow the carbocation time to form. So it won't be able to come to pull off the hydrogen on its own. So we'll have this dissociation first, which is actually the same step as in an SN1 reaction, which is, in fact, an important point. Since the SN1 and E1 reactions pass through exactly the same since SN1 and SN2 reactions pass through exactly the same intermediate, there will always be some SN1 that occurs with E1 and vice versa. Which one's going to happen really depends on a case-by-case basis. Often, if you have a large nucleophile,
that would have difficulty substituting that might influence the product mixture and end up giving you a bit more elimination. But nucleophile is not directly related to the overall reaction rate. It is just the formation of this carbocation. So solvent or nucleophile may influence which one of these occurs, but you're always going to have both together. And at the level of this OChem course, you know, this is not an advanced OChem course. I mean, it's comparable to a chem major's course, but even then, there's certain details you skim over in the first year. So I'm not going to ask you questions of how to know when will E1 versus SN1 occur. What we're going to see in just a moment is, more importantly, can you tell whether SN1 and E1 is occurring versus SN2 or E2? Now, coming back to finish the mechanism, in an SN1 reaction, the nucleophile would come along and substitute at this point. Getting your Thanksgiving groove on early. So, nucleophile comes in, rips off a hydrogen that has to be on the carbon next door to where the carbocation is. Once that occurs, you're going to form the alkene. Why is it unimolecular? Because, again, the formation of the carbocation is the rate-limiting step. And since only the substrates involved in forming that carbocation, then that's why only that substrate's in the rate law. So let me briefly give you the summary of the six flashcard aspects of this reaction, so you can make your flashcard. How many of you have been making your flashcards? That's pretty good. I hope the rest of you who didn't raise your hands, that's your Thanksgiving dinner coma project. All right. Now, utility. The synthetic utility is just like E2. It's to take an alkyl halide and turn it into an alkene. Now, when I say alkyl halide, there's always going to be this footnote that we could be talking about sulfonates as well. So just keep that in mind. As far as the types of reagents that are used, like SN1, this only works if you use weak, non-basic nucleophiles. Because if you have something that's basic, it's going to cause SN2 or E2 instead. Conditions: polar protic solvents. Same again as SN1. Mechanism we have up above. So in terms of stereochem, I want to skip over that one for the moment. It's basically the same as the E2 reaction, where you've got to get the p orbital that forms to be parallel to whatever leaving group, whichever hydrogen is going to be removed in order to make that pi bond. But I want to get to regiochems. Because for regiochem, and this discussion we'll have next week when we come back to break, about the stability of different alkenes. More substituted alkenes are preferred. And because this is a carbocation mechanism, carbocation rearrangement is technically possible. It's not in this example I gave because we already have a tertiary carbocation. It would not want to go from tertiary being a primary again. So this one product I've shown, of course, even if it moved to primary, you'd still get the product. But carbocation migration is just not going to occur in this example. Questions? All right. Then what we were supposed to do on Monday until we ran out of time was to have our the workshop on synthesis. And so what I want to talk about are the different factors that's going to influence whether SN1 occurs SN2, E1, or E2. Now, we could, yes?
So the reagent for E1 and SN1 is the same?
That's right. That's right. And we could get lost in endless discussions of, all right, if you have this particular secondary substrate, secondary is rough because it can do all four reactions. If you have this particular secondary substrate and you have this kind of basic but not really nucleophile that's kind of strong but not, and it's got some steric hindrance on it but not a bunch, which of the four reactions will occur? Well, and if you're a chem major, you might worry about that, but I'm more worried about more clear-cut cases. And let me show you some of the specific cases I'm worried about. In fact, we can break these down really into two broad classifications. Because really, it's eliminations that we're worried about. That substitution can happen as long as you don't have something that's too strong or basic. Any luck?
Can you say it?
Yes.
They're very positive on changing it. So they asked us to, who really wants to take second three, put your
is
on the list. Take your red pen, put your student ID right in front of your name. We're going to hand this list to Dr. Gray. Dr. Gray is going to give this to the dean, and they are going to transfer you to the section three.
Manually.
Okay.
Manually.
Okay.
So, however, if by the 3 o'clock, I would say, in the afternoon, the time has changed but you're not transferred, get your, add the third section.
Okay. So this is if you're already enrolled, is what they're saying?
Anything. If you're enrolled and you're in wait list, you're not enrolled, but...
You want to be in the section.
You want to be in the section three, and your name is here.
Already.
Put your student ID in red in front of your name.
Okay. And then I'll ask them to send a note to section three because we need to make sure they're included in this.
Yeah, they already contacted. I think they contacted them already.
They did.
They're built in. That's why it's frozen at 23.
By the way, people, don't try to add section three right now because it's blocked. You can't add it right now.
Okay, good.
Until
they fix it.
They change the time.
Okay.
So... just put your student ID if your name's here.
All right.
It was pointless for us to sign the name with
no history. We just told them some people are not sure if they want to.
If you need a fresh piece of paper so it's more legible, if you want to.
It's okay.
Okay.
Because you just want their name.
Okay.
Their student ID. Okay.
So, yes. So the situation with bio is that they need that one particular room to do 6B in. And they also have the other bio courses that run after, and I guess there's some even before it. And so they have to move all of their courses around to be able to juggle schedule-wise, I presume, moving their labs around. We're able to move. They're not really. I had that discussion with the chair yesterday. And yes, the schedule changes from the fall to the winter, but it's again because of that particular course needing to be in that particular room. Yes.
So
until you're in, I'd say don't do anything.
But I
mean. Oh, go to the division office, see what they can do for you. Yeah, I'm sorry if you're having a little hassle, but the only reason I keep sending you is because I can't stop class to go take care of it right now. That's the only, otherwise I'd come help you. All right, so back to where we were. The two broad cases we're worried about. If you've got a basic nucleophile or if you have a non-basic nucleophile. So let's handle the basic nucleophile first. And so this is our discussion of SN2 versus SN1 versus E2 versus E1. Yes, I know you all need to get registered, but please, the rest of the class is trying to listen to the lecture, so just please keep it very quiet. All right, so for a basic nucleophile, let's take a primary substrate. If we had a primary substrate and something basic like sodium hydroxide, the major product is going to be SN2. So if you have a primary, most primaries, SN2 is more likely. E2 is not impossible. But E2 is much more likely the more hindered the system becomes. So, in fact, if we move up to a secondary substrate, and even with a small molecule like sodium hydroxide, you are going to get possibly some substitution, but you're also going to get a non-zero quantity of the elimination product. Because just moving up to a secondary is enough steric hindrance to start making elimination more likely, because it slows down substitution enough. And let me make that comment. More elimination due to more steric hindrance. Now, this is the substrate becoming bulkier, you could say. What if the nucleophile itself had steric hindrance? You know, even if the reactive site is accessible, but we use a hindered nucleophile, like the T-butoxide ion. For a secondary, you've just pretty much guaranteed elimination. And then tertiary, SN2 is not possible. So if you throw anything basic at it, the only thing that's going to happen is elimination. And this is all, again, under the heading of using basic nucleophiles. And I'll summarize the trends one more time. Substitution happens the less steric hindrance that you have. So primary, substitution, usually the main product. Secondary, once a day, right? Secondary, substitution's likely, but elimination's possible because you've got some steric hindrance. The more bulk that you put on the nucleophile, if it's basic, the more elimination's going to occur. And again, for tertiary, since you can't have substitution, the only thing that's going to happen is elimination. Question about these four examples, then. Yes?
So the
first one, is E2 not impossible? Not impossible. Elimination can happen on primaries. But unless you use a really hindered nucleophile, substitution is easy enough that you get the substitution product. Now, if the basic nucleophile would be one category, that's going to mean that non-basic nucleophiles will be our other category. And let's do a primary, secondary, tertiary example again. So something like bromoethane, but now using water. I think even the text points out that you get a tiny, tiny, small quantity of this to form. Not because of SN1, because forming a primary carbocation just really is not favorable. But you'll get a slow SN2. Or even more often, you might just not have any reaction. So in a really technical sense, you'll get a slow reaction, but often nothing will happen. As soon as we go to secondary, though, now the formation of a carbocation is possible. But because you have the same intermediate to form the substitution product, you'll automatically get some elimination. So you get E1 and SN1. And again, at the level of this course, we're not going to worry about how much of one versus the other forms. Tertiary, much, much more rapid reaction. But that's only because the carbocation is easier to form. As far as the product, you're still going to have a mix of substitution and elimination. So the non-basic nucleophiles, and I'll put in parentheses here, that we're even more especially talking about the weak non-basic nucleophiles. Essentially, it's just SN1 and E1, but not for primers. I'll say it one more time. We could spend a lot of time worrying about whether this one will happen or that one will happen, but I'm not going to try to catch you on the most obscure of cases. Again, I want you to know these main trends. And I guess I'll put in the same summary statement I did in the other section, that the type of reaction that occurs depends on the structure of the substrate and the basicity and bulkiness, which means size, of the nucleophile. Why don't we have some examples of how I'm going to get it? Do you know these trends or not? Because this is leading us into, if any of you know anybody from the past OChem classes, if you just say fill in the blank problem, you're going to make them smile. Because this is one of the most common types of problems we're going to have on all exams from now on. And let me show you an example of one of these fill-in-the-blank problems. Let's say that I have a tosylate, which, given the fact that I've mentioned what tosylates are and I'm now using a tosylate as my example, what do you think the probability is that you're going to need to know the structure of a tosylate? 150%, that's right. So I say it reacts with something to make this ether. What goes in the box? Of course. Very good. Ethanol. Correct. But why? Well, what kind of reaction happened here? Why SN1? Why does it have to be a weak? I mean, you're right, but why does it have to be a weak nucleophile? Because we're not actually told what the nucleophile is supposed to be. Because the leaving group has to leave, like you were saying, and that's because, yes, it's tertiary. So, she correctly identified we have substitution. We don't have elimination, so it has to be SN1 or SN2. Identified that, yes, it is a weak nucleophile because that's the only way we're going to get a tertiary substrate to react, which means it has to be an SN1 reaction. So this reaction is a substitution reaction on a tertiary substrate. Which means a weak non-basic nucleophile must be used. And that means the answer is ethanol. And I'll put in parentheses here, cannot be sodium ethoxide. Because if it were, what reaction would you have instead? Would cause E2. Is that that same group of people chattering out there? Do I need to go shoo them away again? Anyways, I'm just glad they won't ever hear that. I think I need the break as much as you all, huh? Oh, gosh. And it will be, I hope. So, let's do another example, because we did, or were there questions about that previous one first? Okay, so we did, we just saw one where the reagent is missing. Now, much like the quiz that you had, where you had to predict products, in Section 2, we are going to go over the answers to the quiz today in lab, so you can have those answers to study over the break. But let's say we had something like this. Alkyl halide reacts with sodium cyanide to make something. Now take 10, 15 seconds to try to figure out what the Lewis dot structure of the cyanide ion is. Which should be pretty easy because there's only two atoms there. Carbon has 4 valence electrons as a neutral atom, nitrogen 5. This is a negatively charged ion. So 4 plus 5 plus 1 gives us 10 valence electrons total, which the only way to do this without violating the octet rule is to make a triple bond and put a lone pair on both the carbon and the nitrogen, which if we do, nitrogen has a formal charge of 0, carbon has a formal charge of negative 1. It was pointed out in the other section, wait, nitrogen's more electronegative than carbon is. But it can't, the only way it could get the negative charge is we made a quadruple bond, which is not physically possible for nitrogen. So that is the structure of cyanide. It is basic, and it's negatively charged, so it's a reasonably strong nucleophile. So which reaction is the one likely to occur? SN2. Why? Because we have a primary substrate. It's not a bulky base. It's not huge, tiny. And it's not as basic even as hydroxide is. So, it's SN2, because we have a primary substrate, and we have a basic but non-bulky nucleophile. If it's SN2, then that means substitution. Which, this is kind of an unusual way of writing it, where I'm writing the C in there, but the reason I did so is because this is a functional group known as a nitrile. And this is actually a very sneaky reaction because it's one of the relatively few carbon-carbon bond-forming reactions. So as we go through this whole sequence of courses, the majority of reactions that we learn are going to be to transform one functional group into another. But if you're going to make large molecules, you got to be able to have a way to stitch carbons together. And that's what we've done. Carbon happened to be in an ionic compound in this case, but it does make a carbon-carbon bond once the substitution occurs. If you put a nitrile in extraordinarily basic or acidic conditions, you can convert that nitrile into a carboxylic acid, which then can be converted into esters, anhydrides, acyl halides, esters, amides, several different functional groups. And from there, you could get to practically any other functional group, with a little bit of work. So it's one way to introduce a new carbon-carbon bond into a compound. But here's our example of the product being missing. Why don't we do one last problem where the reactant, the substrate is missing. So, what kind of reaction is going to happen in this case?
Elimination.
It has to be E1 or E2 because we got a double bond. Which one? Why E2? Bulky basic nucleophile. We got a negative charge on that oxygen and it's basic. So this is E2 because we have an alkene produced. Tertiary substrate, which, actually that's not necessarily true, and let's discuss that, but it is true we have a basic bulky nucleophile. All right, so there are actually three kinds of answers you can give. One would be like this. Because if we know that we make an alkene, we know that there had to have been a leaving group somewhere on this molecule. And it had to have been at one of the two positions where this alkene is located. Because E2 doesn't have carbocation migration. So wherever the double bond formed, one of those positions used to have the leaving group. If I put it at this tertiary position, this is actually not the best answer. Because if I reacted it even with sodium hydroxide, substitution's not possible, so only elimination's going to occur. But we could get three different products. The one we want, plus going the other direction along the ring, plus, and somehow I skipped over this yesterday, maybe off on that methyl group as well. So if I only show one product, and if the question says only one product forms, well, then this wouldn't be the right answer. And that means we're left with four other possibilities, which on this type of fill-in-the-blank question, I wouldn't necessarily ask you to draw all the possible reactants. If there are multiple products that form, that I would ask for. But in terms of reactants, we're going to have these four possibilities. Four different diastereomers of having a methyl group and a bromine right next to each other. But this ties into the discussion that we started lecture out today with, because in two of these cases, the hydrogen, which I didn't write in, but which is there, ends up trans, which means the reaction can occur because anti-periplanar geometry is possible. But for the other case, if we draw the hydrogen in, we'll see that it is I circled the wrong one, I'm sorry. Darn. Here we go, got it. This one is trans. So those two work. These other two are cis. Thank you. Now that's not fair. There we go. Oh. There's whole lectures I would have liked to have done that to in the past. Cis means it's not going to happen because anti-periplanar geometry is not possible. So, neither of these would be good choices. Either the first or the last one make the same molecule because you lose the stereocenter once elimination occurs. So either of those would have been acceptable answers. We're out of time, so any last questions before we end? Then have a wonderful break. Exam 2, question 1. First question is about different types of carbocations. So you had a primary, a secondary, a tertiary, and you were told in the question that these different carbocations form at different rates, the tertiary forming more quickly than the secondary than the primary. Now, I did indicate during the test not to focus on kinetics, not to be thrown by that word, the phrase, the faster rate. What really I was getting at was the stability of those carbocations, but I couldn't use that word because that's part of the answer itself. That a tertiary versus a secondary versus a primary carbocation experiences more hyperconjugation. So that hyperconjugation is what stabilizes and spreads out the positive charge and makes it easier to form. So you are asked to do a Smog diagram, an appropriate Smog diagram. Some of you did a general picture of a primary or tertiary carbocation, which was fine to do. But many of you stated that you were drawing a structure for molecule C, which was the tertiary carbocation, but then left one of the carbons out by accident. So I'm going to go ahead and write out the full Smog for molecule C. So central carbon is sp2 hybridized. All the other carbons are sp3 hybridized. Where you do have the carbocation, you do have a p orbital as well. So here are the three sp3 hybridized carbons that are directly attached to that carbocation. And then if you were drawing molecule C, here's that extra methyl group that many of you accidentally left out. Of course, there are hydrogens on those sp3 hybridized orbitals as well. And you should go ahead and show the hyperconjugation interactions that are possible because that's kind of the point of the Smog diagram. Now, one very minor point is that some of you connected the line from the carbocation coming to this ethyl group and connected it all the way to the end.
But hyperconjugation does not really occur more than one atom away, because you don't have the orbital overlap, and it's not conjugation. So the line from the carbocation should have only gone to those carbons that are immediately next door. Also, since the other atoms are sp3 hybridized, they don't have p orbitals left on them. So some of you had the right idea that there's this interaction and more interactions with more carbons around, but it's not because there's p orbitals, there's not conjugation occurring, it's just hyperconjugation. So questions on this first problem? All right, then moving on to the second problem. This was about the allyl anion. The question says that the true structure of the molecule is not able to be shown by either one of these resonance structures. So you're asked to draw a smog first for the allyl anion, and then you're asked to explain how and why neither resonance structure can reflect that true structure. The how part is, what is it about that resonance structure that's not correct? The why is getting at, well, delocalization. So to answer that then, neither of these structures is correct because the anion is not located just on one carbon. It is delocalized, it is spread out across the molecule. So to represent it as being in only one place is incorrect. The way that many of you said that is that that place where you do have the negative charge would be sp3 hybridized, whereas the other two carbons are sp2, but in reality, all of them are sp2 hybridized. So that's how it's incorrect. Why it's incorrect? Well, we don't have a writing system that can handle delocalized electrons. So we have to write it in this way, so at least we can count electrons, but it's not the correct structure. So Lewis dot structures, or in this case, line structures, cannot represent delocalized electrons. You're asked to draw a smog diagram for this, and as I said just a moment ago, all three carbons in this case are going to be sp2 hybridized. So it's going to look like this. Again, there's hydrogens on each one of those atoms. And then we have conjugation occurring this time, not hyperconjugation. Now, if you had drawn the smog based on one of the resonance structures, you would have gotten partial credit, but you missed part of the point of the question, that those resonance structures are not correct. So you can't base your smog diagram off of them. Questions on those problems, on that specific one? All right, moving to question three. This was the mechanisms for the SN1 and SN2 reactions. So you had reaction A, we had a primary alkyl halide reacting with sodium hydroxide. So since it's primary, and since you have hydroxide, there's going to be SN2 that occurs. Now, at the time that you took the exam, we hadn't had as much discussion of when SN1 versus SN2 will occur, but you were required to know the two mechanisms, and what was on the exam were basically, if not the same, that almost identical to the examples I'd given in class. But most of you did correctly recognize that it is an SN2 reaction. So nucleophile attacks, kicks off the leaving group. The one place where many of you did make an error is that because it's SN2, you're going to have inversion of configuration. So the hydroxide will not be pointed the same way as what the leaving group was. For reaction B, we had a tertiary alkyl halide that reacted with water. Tertiary, weak nucleophile, means SN1. So first, the leaving group comes off. Notice that the... I have mentioned several times in the past that arrows don't show the direction of atoms moving. They show the direction of electrons moving. In this case, though, it happens to be the same thing. The pair of electrons in that bond comes to bromine because bromine is coming off. You make the carbocation, which water attacks. But since it's planar, it attacks from above and below, so you're going to get two different products out. Now, it was fine if in your mechanism you only showed one product, and at the end you said plus an antimer. I'll go ahead and write both of the products out, but as long as you acknowledge that there were two possible products, it was fine. Yes? If you drew a squiggly line, is that how you answered it? Let me take a look at it afterwards then. So here's our two intermediates, positively charged oxygen. So in both cases, a hydrogen will come off. This time, the arrow is opposite the direction the atom's going because the pair in the bond falls back to oxygen. So we end up with two alcohols as our product. Questions on number 3. All right, then for number 4, you're asked to draw reaction coordinate diagrams. So in grading this problem, I looked at your answer for problem 3. Because there were a few of you that either forgot the deprotonation step or had hydroxide attack, which that reminds me. Some of you have this idea if there's water around, that there'll be hydroxide around as well. That is technically true, but realize that at room temperature for pure water, the concentration of hydroxide is 10 to the negative 7th molar. So in other words, incredibly small. And so effectively, there really isn't hydroxide in solution as far as reacting in an organic reaction. So anytime that you see water as a reagent, you cannot treat it as hydroxide. And that did show up in some of your answers for this SN1 mechanism. It really is water itself that does the attacking. But if you showed only two steps in your mechanism, then you would need to show only two steps in your reaction coordinate diagram. This particular version of SN1 has three steps, and so that means there need to be three steps in your reaction coordinate diagram. Now let's back up and look at the SN2 problem first. For A, since it's a one-step reaction, we're only going to have one hump on the curve of the reaction coordinate diagram, corresponding to having only one transition state, and then one activation energy. There are no intermediates, because there's just the transition state, but we do have our reactants and products. The directions indicated that the reaction was exothermic, which implicit in that was the fact that you should have lower energy for the products than reactants, but also, since I didn't give you any information about entropy, that it would have been fine if you labeled the energy scale as being in terms of delta H. Now, for the SN1 reaction, again, the full reaction has three steps, so we're going to have three transition states, so we're going to have three hills on our reaction coordinate diagram. Now, you were not given enough information about the intermediates to know exactly which one was higher or lower in energy, other than the fact that the first step is the rate-limiting step, with which that you should have been familiar with. If that's the rate-limiting step, then that should have the highest activation energy. So as long as the other two steps, the other two hills, had lower activation energy, and as long as you made the product overall lower in energy, where the position of intermediate number two was, I guess is what I'm getting at, was unimportant. So there's our three stages, two intermediates, a product, there's our reactants. Again, the reaction will have three hills in it, with the first activation energy being the largest. Notice that the activation energies are drawn starting from the reagent or intermediate that immediately precedes the transition state. You don't look at just the original reactant for all the different activation energies. It's just for that first step of the reaction. And one common subtle mistake, some of you for the first activation energy started it from the same line as the intermediate. That would be true for the reverse reaction. If you're focusing on the forward reaction, then it starts from the lowest point of where you came from in the immediate previous step. Oh, I need to label my transition states. But these would be two complete reaction coordinate diagrams. So questions about the reaction coordinate diagrams? Then question five still refers back to question three. You had these two different reactions, but it talks about their stereochemical outcomes. For reaction A, you end up with an optically active solution. For reaction B, you end up with an optically inactive solution. Why is that? Well, for reaction A, it's because you only end up with one molecule and it's chiral. It isn't enough just to say the molecule has stereocenters, because you can have something that's meso, for example. Meso has stereocenters, but it's not chiral. So you do have to specifically refer to the fact that you have a chiral product, which is why you have optical activity. Solution B, though, the presumption was, because you weren't given any other information, that the reaction was racemic. Now, we have since talked about how in real life SN1 is not always going to be racemic because of the formation of ion pairs. But you're told it's optically inactive, which means you'd assume that it was racemic. Because with that SN1 mechanism, you should know you form both products, which are enantiomers of each other. Since you form both products and they're enantiomers, and if you form them in equal proportion, that's going to cause self-cancellation in the solution, which means overall the solution is optically inactive. Now, nomenclature. You all did fairly well with that nomenclature. I don't know if it's because you had the extra time to practice, but still, you got it. So first molecule was a deuterated cyclic alcohol. So building from the end of the name forward, this is cyclohexanol, which you don't need a number for it, because if you only have one of the most important functional groups on that cyclic molecule, it's automatically got the one position. So the end of this name will be cyclohexanol. There's three substituents. There's a deuterium and methyls. The D in deuterium comes before M in methyl, so we're going to have methyl being last. There's two of them, both at the 4 position. So that'll be 4,4-dimethyl. The deuterium itself is deutero. Now, I know that I have somewhat poor handwriting sometimes, so I can't fault you, but I do want to point out this D. Not D-E-N. Many of you studied together, so you had the same answer, but you had the same wrong answer. But for such a minor mistake, I didn't take points off. I just want to point out that is deutero. D-U-E-U, it's a root word meaning two. Now, we have stereocenters on the molecule. So before any of this, we need to designate where we have R and S. But notice this is not exactly a trick question, but this is not a stereocenter up at the top of the molecule, because you have two of the same substituent, and since you have two of the same, it's not a stereocenter.
So let's tackle the alcohol position first, since that's position one. Oxygen's more important than carbon, so it's priority one. The ring is symmetric other than the fact we have the deuterium. Since deuterium is more important than hydrogen, then the left part of the ring is more important than the right. So it looks like one, two, three, clockwise direction, but the least important substituent is pointed out towards you, which means whatever we see, we got to reverse. And so that really is S. The other stereocenter, carbon with oxygen versus carbon. The ring's not symmetric from this point, and the first point of difference, though, you have an oxygen where the other side you don't. So carbon with oxygen, priority one. Carbon without oxygen, priority two. Deuterium, priority three. And that is, again, S.
So the full name of this compound is 1S2S2-deutero-4,4-dimethylcyclohexanol. Questions on that naming? All right, then. The other compound, which was another alcohol. So one common problem with this is how to handle the fact that you had three alcohols. And it all has to do with the letter N that's in that name. So for example, if we have a six-carbon alkane, that's going to be hexane. If you had a six-carbon compound with a double bond, that's hexene. So the vowel changed from A to E, but the N is still there. If it's a triple bond, it would be hexine. But that's for hydrocarbons. For other functional groups, it's what's after the N that changes. So you have, for example, hexanol for an alcohol, hexanal for an aldehyde, hexanone for a ketone, hexanoic acid. But the N is there in each of the cases. So this is a triol. So, and because this has seven carbons in as long as chain, it's going to be heptane triol. So it's not heptatriol. The stem there, that N, stays there. The only time that anything changes related to it is whether you have an alkane, ene, or ine. So, end of the name. Heptane, 1,3,3-triol.
You keep the E in this case because T comes afterwards. If you didn't put the E in, I didn't take points off because it's so minor, but it is technically correct with the E. Yes?
Would there ever be a molecule that has hepta without the E?
No. Okay. No. Yes?
Because the N part is still part of the stem. So you don't drop the N when you're adding a functional group ending. You drop just the E. So if you look at, let me write this down so you can see it.
Probably wrote those a little small, but propane, may not even. Propane, own, propanol, propanamine, propane thiol. So the end never disappears when you put a functional group ending on it.
So, heptane 1,3,3-triol, we have three substituents again.
We have an ethyl and a dimethyl, but the D in the di does not get alphabetized. I know it's kind of a squirrely rule, but that is the rule. So you, even though it's two of them, you just look at the M in methyl, and that's higher than the E in ethyl. So the methyls, again, in this problem are going to go last.
We have those at the 2 and the 4 position. So we'll have 2, 4 dimethyl. We have the ethyl at the 5 position. And we again have stereocenters.
So the first stereocenter position, 2, we have carbon with 2 oxygens, carbon with 1 oxygen, and carbon with just hydrogens. So 1, 2, 3, it looks counterclockwise, but again, the least important substituent is pointed out at you, so it's really R. The other stereocenter, we're also going to reverse whatever we see because the least important group is pointed out at you. And so we have carbon with oxygens, carbon with just carbons, and then carbon with just hydrogens. So 1, 2, 3, it looks clockwise, but it's reversed, so it's S.
So this is going to be 2R, 4S, 5 ethyl, 2, 4 dimethyl, heptane, 1, 3, 3, triol. Questions? Last problem, then, was about equilibrium. And let me write out the reaction, because there was one common wrong answer that's shown up in all three sections. Notice that sodium hydroxide does not show up anywhere in this equation. And yes, when we were discussing acids and bases, we had a long discussion about what is a weak acid. What would happen if you neutralize a weak acid with a strong base? But that is not the reaction taking place here. In fact, the opposite, you have an acid that's present. If you were to somehow add sodium hydroxide to this, you would stop the reaction. So sodium hydroxide has nothing to do with this problem. It's all to do just with the ethanol that's there, or even more importantly, the water that's produced. Because the problem first asks you to define what equilibrium is, and then using those definitions of equilibrium, describe a way that you could cause this reaction to go entirely to completion. So I had warned you ahead of time that the three definitions were that there's no change in the concentration of reactants and products, that the reaction is at its lowest energy point, and that the rates of the forward and reverse reactions are equal to each other. How could you make the reaction go forward? Well, the answer most of you gave was what we did in real life for one of our experiments, which is to remove the product as it is formed. Because if you remove the product, you drop Q below K. You've changed the concentrations, but even more importantly, you have fewer products than you should. So Q is less than K, and so the reaction is going to go forward. Well, if Q is less than K, that means the rate of the forward reaction is going to be greater than the reverse reaction. And any time you disturb equilibrium, you're going to higher potential energy. So those are the three definitions being related to this method of force and reaction forward. Again, you're making Q less than K, rate of forward reaction greater than reverse, and raising the energy, the effective potential energy of the system. Now, sulfuric acid is a catalyst, and the question also asks, why is it that a catalyst does not affect the balance of products or reactants? And that's because it doesn't change the products and reactants. Hess's law says that the change of energy for a chemical reaction only depends on those products and reactants, and so if you're not changing them, you're not changing the overall reaction energy. Because of that, you're not changing equilibrium. Now, it will change the rate of the reaction because you give it a different pathway, you give it a different activation energy. But that activation energy, again, has nothing to do with what the products and reactants are. Yes?
had either state Hess's law or describe it. If you didn't name it as Hess's law, that might have been okay as long as you described it fully enough. But you could have said Hess's law because that does govern or does describe how only if the reactant or product changes will the energy of the reaction change. All right, let's go over now the answers to the quiz. And I don't have those ready, but we can at least go over the answers so you can study that. Because, in fact, in lecture today, we're going to now talk about, well, when will SN1 versus SN2 versus E1 versus E2 occur? Now, that means, I believe, we're going to be behind in our lecture schedule now, but that's unfortunately kind of unavoidable. So, the first problem of the quiz, I won't write the answers down here because they're already in the notes. Because what you had was an alkane, an alkyne, an alcohol, and a carboxylic acid. And those are the exact same examples that I had given in class addressing each of the three reasons why they are more acidic, why the alkyne, alcohol, and carboxylic acid are more acidic than the alkane. When comparing an alkane versus an alkyne, you have sp hybridization on the alkyne versus sp3. And when you put an anion in an sp3 hybridized orbital, that's more favorable than putting in an sp3. So hybridization is one of the effects that distinguishes alkynes from alkanes. The alcohol has an oxygen. That oxygen is electron withdrawing, it's electronegative, and so that pulls electron density away from the hydrogen to make it more acidic. And so that's the inductive effect. For the carboxylic acid, yes, you have a second oxygen, but even more importantly, once you dissociate the proton off of that acid, you end up with something that's resonance stabilized. So that's the resonance effect, that if something makes the product more distributed in terms of its charge, it's more favorable to form. Now, there was some controversy about the pKa value. So I'm going to go back, listen to the lecture recordings to see if I had asked at that time whether you were going to be responsible for pKa's or not. Even if I had, I'm not sure whether, I don't think I even mentioned pKa's when we were reviewing for the quiz. I think I just focused on the fact that you needed to know these three trends. So it may turn out where I won't grade that problem in terms of the pKa values. But since the problem did ask about the differences and what the reasons are that there's a difference in acidity there, you needed to at least be able to address hybridization, inductive effect, and resonance. Now, any questions about that problem before we get to the real meat of the quiz, which is the SN1 and SN2 pairs? Then let's get to those pairs of reactions. Which, all right, so first reaction was with a primary alkyl halide, a chiral primary alkyl halide, reacting with sodium hydroxide versus a secondary alkyl halide reacting with sodium hydroxide. So we only had the SN1 and SN2 reactions we were dealing with, so you needed to decide which one of the two was going to occur here. Well, which of the two could occur for either of these compounds? So, if we're looking just at the substrate, primary substrates can undergo which reactions? Just SN2, right? What about secondary?
Both, SN1 and SN2. But what kind of nucleophile do we have here? Strong and it's basic. So strong basic nucleophile means that SN2 is going to happen in both cases. We have a primary versus a secondary substrate in an SN2 reaction. Which one would therefore be more favorable? The primary. So the first reaction is the faster reaction. Now there was a concern brought up again in one of the other sections about how could you answer this question if you weren't given concentrations and such. Since they weren't given as part of the question wasn't trying to address concentration. It was focused just on this difference between substrates, exactly the same types of factors we had been discussing in class. So just on the basis of not knowing concentrations, but seeing these two comparisons, there is going to be a big difference using a primary versus a secondary substrate. So this is SN2. Because we have primary and secondary, and we have, even more importantly, a strong basic nucleophile, and the primary is going to be faster than the secondary due to the lack of steric hindrance. Now, the second problem, similar type of thing. This is a little bit different set of molecules than what your section had, but the same idea was there. I changed the molecules just to make it fit on the paper a little bit better when I rewrote the quiz. So we have a secondary again and a primary again. Oh, I didn't write the product. I'm sorry. The product is going to be an alcohol with inversion of configuration. Now back to the second one. Secondary versus primary, but what kind of nucleophile do we have this time? We have a weak, non-basic nucleophile, so what kind of reaction should occur? SN1, but can SN1 happen with primaries? Not really. Maybe the tiniest trace can occur if you let the solution sit around for forever, but essentially, no. So really, only the first reaction is going to happen in this case. So SN1, because we have a weak, non-basic nucleophile, and the secondary is better than the primary due to hyperconjugation. The next pair of reactions. Oh, sorry, product. You'll again get alcohols, but you'll get alcohols, plural. Because you're again going to have substitution from either side of the carbocation. Yes? And it's due to hyperconjugation, but that's fine. If you didn't use the word hyperconjugation, but you said the carbocation is more stable, that's fine. Next pair of reactions. This is the only one that you might be able to call a trick question, but this is really getting back to mechanism. Because you have the same substrate, tertiary substrate, and you have two different nucleophiles. What kind of nucleophiles are these, though? Weak nucleophiles, they're non-ionic. And so given a tertiary, well, even not looking at the nucleophile, given the substrate and the fact you weren't responsible for elimination reactions at the time, what's the only reaction that's possible? SN1. Now, you might have been tempted to look at this and say, oh, well, sulfur is squishier, more polarizable than oxygen. But does the nucleophile have the effect on the rate of an SN1 reaction?
Because the test that we just reviewed, the answer to that one problem where in the rate-limiting step, if you don't have... We never did review that part of it, did we? We wrote the reaction coordinate diagrams, but we didn't talk about rate.
I'm sorry. Backing up just for a moment, because this is important.
If we look at those two reaction coordinate diagrams, part of this question was, why is it that in reaction A, both the concentration of the substrate and the nucleophile matter for reaction rate, whereas in reaction B, only the concentration of the substrate matters? Well, because of reaction A, you only have one reaction step. So both molecules are automatically involved in that one reaction step. So they both are in the rate limiting step, and so they're both in the rate law. But in the second reaction, that formation of the carbocation is this step with the largest activation barrier, so it is the rate limiting step, and there is no other reagent that is reacting at that time, and so only the substrate is going to have effect of the rate of the reaction.
Coming back now to this problem that you had on your quiz, I'll say it again. Only the substrate's going to have effect on the rate of reaction, and since you have the same substrate, that means they both go at the same rate.
Now, as far as the product,
I'll just take the first one, because when you had the case of two reactions being equal rate, you only had to write the product for one.
And so there's an example. For the other one, it would just be sulfur instead of oxygen. Question about any of these three so far?
All right, then the next one. Oh, but let me write down here, sorry. SN1. Weak nucleophile, tertiary substrate. They're the same rate because only the substrate is in the rate law. Next reaction. This is where the identity of the nucleophile comes up. Because we again have primary substrates and we have basic nucleophiles again. So that means SN2. Since it's SN1, since it's SN2, because it's primary, the nucleophile does matter in this case.
And so now the fact that sulfur is bigger and squishier, and if you use the word squishier, yes, that was allowable, but since it's more polarizable, it forms a bond more easily to kick off that leaving group, and so sulfur ends up being the better nucleophile. Now remember, we talked about halogens as well, and it turns out that the benefit of polarizability for halogens is not as good not as strong a determining factor for its reactivity as the basicity of the halogens. But for this case, oxygen versus sulfur, polarizability is the more important factor.
So it's the second reaction that goes more quickly. And the product in this case would be a thiol. And so, sulfur, better nucleophile, due to polarizability.
Question?
Okay. Last reaction then.
Oh, yes. A sulfonate, specifically a mesylate, reacting with sodium hydroxide versus an alkyl fluoride reacting with sodium hydroxide. So again, this is SN2 reaction because we have primary substrates and a strong basic nucleophile. And it's going to be the sulfonate that reacts more quickly.
Which would be true regardless of whether it's SN1 or SN2, because for both reactions, it is the structure of the substrate that matters. Even if you didn't remember pKa values, you should have remembered that fluoride out of the halogens is a poor leaving group, because fluoride is basic, where the other three halogens are not. Yes?
Not really. So there's some cases where it can be a leaving group, but fluorine has kind of messy reactivity. So it really is a very, very poor leaving group to use.
Sulfonates, though, are conjugate bases of really strong acids. So they're excellent leaving groups. So it's going to be the first reaction that's a quicker.
Because again, sulfonates are good leaving groups. Could also say fluoride is basic, so it's a poor leaving group. And since it's sodium hydroxide that was reacting, our product is going to be an alcohol.
Quiz questions. All right, so let me pause and flip over into lab mode.